Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
So, good morning. February is the month that we focus a bit on refuge, taking refuge. And the three refuges that we take are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And there are many different ways we talk about those. The Buddha is the awakened nature that is our own kind of heritage. And we tap into it when we meditate. We begin to connect more intimately with that understanding of ourselves. Dharma is the teachings, of which there are many, many, many teachings that help us in this process. And Sangha is beloved community. It's the community of practitioners. So... today I wanted to talk a little bit about Sangha because we often don't touch on that as deeply as we might, and it's a really critical piece of this process. It's not just the Sangha, the community of practitioners that support us in our practice, which is, of course, very important, but there's way more to it than that. Originally, the Sangha meant just those who were ordained, and that we're practicing meditation in a very rigorous kind of way. There were rules of conduct for that community of the ordained, which fills a huge collection of texts, the Vinaya. Many, many, many rules for how to behave in the monasteries. It starts, of course, with the first five precepts, which is no killing, no stealing, no lying, no misuse of sex, no misuse of intoxicants. Those were the five basic precepts. But then there were hundreds more after that because they found people could always find ways. As we are human beings, we find ways around those. But that was the original Sangha. And then peripheral to that were the lay people in the community who supported the Sangha by providing them with food and other things that they might need. And through their practice of generosity to the Sangha, they could gain some kind of spiritual brownie points. It's called accumulating merit, so that they could be reborn into a more favorable birth and become ordained themselves. So that was the original meaning of Sangha. Taking refuge in the Sangha meant very specifically, I'm joining that community of ordained. That was the original meaning of it. Of course, the meaning has expanded over time, and as Buddhism has moved throughout the world, so that now when we speak of Sangha, we're really talking about the community of Buddhists practicing together, so that this group right now would be the Sangha. And we also, we think beyond that to the folks who are not in the room, the children who are here are now off doing some activities. And so we can move out from this group of practitioners in kind of concentric circles, bigger and bigger groups in which this Buddhist community is nested, so to speak. And there's even a word for it. We say Mahasangha, the greater Sangha. So there's a lot of different ways we can see this. But, you know, for us in the modern world, we're not limited to just one community. So even if we're really active in the Buddhist Sangha that we associate with, we have several other communities that we are a part of and we have some obligation toward, perhaps even other Buddhist communities. I know a number of us practice in several different places and have more or less of a connection with those groups as well. And each community that we're in, that could be the neighborhood community, family community, this island community, work, school, many other things where we have a community of people that we engage in some limited way. And oftentimes in these, all these many communities, our relationship to that community becomes somewhat transactional. In other words, we're going there to get something and the community gives us that. So that this, and that's perfectly fine at a grocery store. We bring money and we get food and that's the way that's supposed to be. But sometimes that transactional quality can kind of bleed back into our relationships with other groups where that transactional way of being is not the most helpful way of being in community. For example, in the Buddhist group, because in this country we are exposed to many, many different Buddhist traditions, we have kind of our choice of how we want to practice, who we want to practice with. Most places, for most of the time, there was one place, that was it. He kind of took it or left it. But now we have a sense of choice about it, which is exciting in some ways, but we have to be careful not to let that ability to choose support and strengthen our preferences for how we do things, right? It's so easy for us when we have a choice of flavors to pick the one we like the best. A whole bin of apples, we pick the one that's prettiest and freshest and all of that. There's a great story about Suzuki Roshi. I love this story where he goes into a grocery store and starts picking through the produce bins and picks out the most scarred and mushy fruits. And his attendant who was with him, the student who was with him, said, "Roshi, we don't need to do that. We can pick better produce." He said, "Oh, I'm not worried about the better produce. Somebody will pick it. But I worry about these going to waste." And that's an example of not allowing our personal preferences to get in the way of what makes sense overall. I love that story. So it's important for us to watch that tendency that we have to reinforce our own ego through feeding into those preferences. The ego is really less important. The ego and its needs or wants is less important in the context of the whole community. Doesn't mean it's not there. It just means we have to find a way to balance it out. Cultural issues, you know, Buddhism came from India, the Hindu kind of context of worldview, through China, where it picked up ways of looking at things from a Taoist or a Confucian perspective, and then finally in Japan, where it blended with an understanding of nature and a different way of studying and a different way of looking at things, a real specific aesthetic. They've all combined and transformed Buddhism into the form that we practice, which is Zen Buddhism from Japan. And we're still really in the very early stages of understanding for ourselves what is so-called cultural baggage and what is essential to the core of the practice. It's not just about the robes and the bells and the bowing and the chanting, but the teachings that have come down from the very beginning. And which of those do we hold on to as well? You know, which ones are out of date at this point? So this is really the stage we're in this country in taking Buddhism into our culture and making it kind of integral to that culture. An example would be the law of karma, which is cause and effect, how cause and effect unfold through our actions. And until fairly recently, Buddhist practice has been a pretty long game, with a multi-lifetime perspective. I had an inmate at one of the prisons who, he'd killed somebody, and we were talking about karma, and I was using some kind of vague language because most of the guys in the group were Westerners, and they weren't into this rebirth sort of stuff. And he said, "That's not karma." He was from Vietnam originally. And I said, "Explain how you understand karma." He said, "Karma is I kill a man, and next life I'm going to be a cockroach." And I said, "How do you understand that? How do you come to that?" He said, "My grandmother told me, next life I'm going to be a cockroach because I killed someone." And I said, "Tell me then why, if you know you're going to be a cockroach in the next life, that you come here and sit with us." He said, "Well, maybe life after that I know cockroach." That is what I call a long game. You know? Mm-hmm. It was very interesting to me because we don't have that way of looking at things. And yet, when we have a funeral in the in this country, a Buddhist funeral, we still do incense and chanting on this first day, this seventh day, every week, up to the 49th day. And that's not just some kind of interesting numerological thing. The 49 days is the days that our being, our, what's left over of the karmic residue that we have, is kind of wandering in a space between life and death and waiting for the next form it can take. And the services that are done each week, and the one on the 49th day being the most important, are to say, "Okay, go that direction. You know, I know it's confusing, there's a lot going on, you're disoriented, but this is the way you're headed." So even in those rituals that we have, we are acknowledging multiple births. And it runs, of course, straight into our Judeo-Christian understanding, cultural understanding. So this is one of the issues that we wrestle with as a Sangha in the West, to try to really understand karma and how that plays out for us and our understanding of how the world works. But in the meantime, you know, we are faced with different ways of understanding these teachings. And sometimes there's this kind of Zen cop-out that I hear. I really dislike it. It's, oh, everything's empty, so it doesn't really matter anyway. And you might think that from the Heart Sutra when we chant, there's no this, no that, no this teaching, no that teaching. It's very confusing. And I think it's kind of, if we don't understand what that means, it can be a cop-out. Well, it doesn't really matter because it's all just a dream. It's all made up. And we also are bringing our own very individualistic, independent-minded worldviews with us to this process. And it directly affects the Sangha when we come into conflict over how to view these things. It's hard sometimes. It's hard sometimes to balance what we may think we should be doing, we should be believing, with what other people are coming to the table with. But there are some particular things I think that that we can look at that really transcend cultural differences and also honor cultural differences. These are things that I've kind of gleaned from how Sanghas have worked in the past. The first and foremost is a real solid, you might call it an ethical basis to our interactions, right? The precepts is one way we look at that. And in many ways, this is the easiest one to look beyond cultural differences. The whole idea of do unto others as you would have them do unto you, it's something that most people can kind of understand. And from that basic understanding, some of these other rules about, but one thing is, let's not try to kill people, you know, basic thing. That sort of thing can be more easily understood. A Buddhist might say, do no harm, try to do good. That would be the same way of saying, do unto others. It's like, think about how you want to be treated and do that going forward. Or as the Dalai Lama says, everybody wants to be happy. Mm-hmm. That's the basis. Everyone wants to be happy. People are not different than me. So however I behave, I have to acknowledge and recognize that. That would be the first thing. Another way that would be helpful is loosening the grip of those personal preferences. And as I say, it's really hard to do when we have so many choices available to us. But Zen is great for this because we've got a lot of rules about how to bow, how to stand, how to drink tea, everything. And they can be irritating and annoying at times. They really, especially if you're old like me and you trained in one way and then you move to another sangha and they do it slightly differently. Keeping that straight is hard, and it's, you know, it's embarrassing if you don't do it right, so to speak. But moving past that embarrassment about doing things to just really plunging into the form and inhabiting it fully is one way in which we can move past our personal preferences. Doesn't mean we have to be, you know, really rigid and do things a certain way and frighten people with our demeanor, but to be just humble with it and smooth with it and kind with it and help use it to help things flow. That's a big help. Another way is to include others when we're looking for benefit. This is a way to overcome that transactional quality. So just like in the chopstick story, it's a very simple adjustment. You feed the person across from you instead of trying to feed yourself. Very simple and easy, and everybody gets fed. And it's that kind of practice of generosity that I think is very, very helpful. And we're not as good in this culture at really appreciating the depth, the profound depth of generosity and how it can be practiced. Another aspect, and this is kind of an interesting one, is openness and transparency within the community. There are kind of two aspects to this. One is based on the very old thing that sanghas used to do, which was on the full moon and the new moon, they would have a meeting where everybody in the sangha would go around and state out loud the ways in which they'd broken the precepts in that period of time. Mm-hmm. So it forced you to be honest with yourself, observant of yourself. And the other piece of it that is really helpful is that it unburdens you on a regular basis of having to carry the embarrassment or the fear around whatever it is you might be doing. Is you say it, the community accepts that and says, well, you know, perhaps you could clean the shoe area for a week just as a way of kind of absolving yourself of that. It's something that was done in the earliest sanghas, and I'm not suggesting that we necessarily do it as a sangha ourselves, just because we are not living together. It's not the same kind of community, and there has to be a sense of confidentiality and trust there that's very deep. The closest that I've seen it is in 12-step groups, where there's, you know, people can reveal things. In fact, they're supposed to reveal things. But there's a very clear situation where that community holds that as a sacred trust, doesn't go out of the room. There needs to be a way in which we can do that as a group as well. And this is true for all of our communities, families, school, work. And, you know, I mean, all of us know environments where secrets have created such a toxic environment that nobody is happy, nobody feels safe. And then there's also a risk of kind of giving up to vertical connection any sense of commitment about how to act, when to act with other people. So a community has to have both a strong vertical component and a strong horizontal component. And that's an area where oftentimes we don't put in the effort in all the many communities we're in because it's hard work. It's very hard work. But we've seen in our own country what's happening now, that it's beginning to polarize because we haven't maintained the connections, the communication, the wanting to trust, the wanting to understand. So working on that horizontal kind of connection is really a key part of openness and transparency with each other. Charlie and I just watched Invictus. I don't know if mm-hmm. any of you know that movie about mm-hmm. Nelson Mandela at the beginning mm-hmm. After apartheid was dismantled and he became president. And one of the first things he did, oddly, was focus on the rugby team. Because the rugby team, he had learned in 27 years of imprisonment, he paid attention to the Afrikaners guards, and they loved that rugby team. It was very important to their sense of personal pride, national pride, and when the newly black-dominated sports authority said, well, we're going to change the name, we're going to change the uniforms and get rid of all that kind of colonial stuff, he said, no. It's so important to keep this because if we get rid of this now at the beginning, mm-hmm. we will lose these people forever. Mm-hmm. And so he invested in making sure the rugby team was supported and connected with the whole country. And it was a wonderful, wonderful movie. And also the effort that had to go into that, first being aware of how important it was, and then putting the effort in to make that happen. Our times really require this of us. This movie is, what, 10 years, 15 years old, maybe? And it resonated with me as being very, very real in this time. We are in the same exact situation in our larger Sangha, our Maha Sangha. And so, you know, we can't just assume this common understanding, and we can't back off from it just because it's uncomfortable. This is the thing that's key to me. We may think, well, I just want to focus on my personal practice. Yes, of course, that's really important. But we have to remember that we only exist as individuals in community. Without community, we don't exist. At the very least, the community of your mother and father. Without that community, you would not exist. And this is true on all levels. So this, to me, is really the key to looking at Sangha as refuge, to explore each of these aspects.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.